A podcast of the cinema.
Hosted, well, yes. No, brought to you by
yes,
you people.
Our club members.
you
the fine
you,
folks of Patreon.
You LK club members who are being so nice on Patreon.
And supporting this program.
There's a problem on Patreon right now, right? With the app or something?
We're ironing it out.
The people have a right to know. Defend yourself.
There are issues with accessing the podcast in more convenient ways. You can always, if nothing else, if you're a Patreon member, go to the site, download it, drag it into your iTunes, and you're good to go.
You can just do
you
that.
You can still do that.
All right. We had this conversation about it that it was impeding people's ability.
No.
To, okay.
No.
No.
You just don't. Understand anything technical,
I don't understand things
ever at all.
It's all when
he's unfrozen caveman lawyer.
Basically, yeah.
When the notice comes each month, Patreon just paid you. I think, is everybody getting what they need to get? You know,
they're getting it. Just they could be getting it easier.
Yeah,
is all. As you may so you're Dave White and I'm Alonzo.
Oh, that's right.
And
yes.
We host this thing.
Yes.
And joining us today, a very dear old friend of ours who has been on the show before. We're thrilled to have him back. He is currently the author of Everything in Your Bookstore Right Now. Please welcome Matt Zollersites.
Hi guys.
So okay, you've got the Oliver Stone Experience.
Yes.
Lush, gorgeous coffee table book that you collaborated on with Mr. Stone. Covering his entire life and filmography all the way up to Snowden. TV, the book that you have co-written with your colleague Alan Sepinwall.
Right.
And also the foreword to Bad Dads, is that the name?
Yes,
of it?
Yes.
The latest in the Wes Anderson collection that you started, right?
I mean, right,
it's
yeah.
Your baby.
Yeah, pretty much. So that's the third volume in the series.
And the Mad Men book.
Oh, right. And Mad Men Carousel, still on sale.
Right.
Indeed. Indeed.
Great bathroom reading. Lots of the chapters are finite.
Thank you.
The Wes Anderson book is not a good bathroom.
No, it's really not. And in fact, the Oliver Stone book even less so. I've warned people not to read those books in bed because they'll injure your solar plexus.
Yeah. You drop it on your knee and you're in big trouble. But
yeah.
So anyway, so you're in town for Stone-related activities?
Yes, this weekend we showed two films at CineFamily. On Friday night we showed The Hand, which Oliver came to the Q&A and we talked about that. This is a 1981 horror film starring Michael Caine as an artist who loses his hand, but the hand comes back.
What was the SCTV parody of that?
I don't remember.
Was it like, my bloody hand?
It might have been.
Michael Caine in my bloody hand!
So, and then tonight we're showing Platoon. It's the 30th anniversary of Platoon, and Jim Beaver is going to do the Q&A for that.
Oh, cool.
And, of course, Jim is, you know, character actor extraordinaire from Deadwood and Justified and Supernatural and a bunch of other stuff, but he's also a film historian. He worked at the AFI for a long time in the 80s. He's written a biography of John Garfield.
Whoa.
And he's a Vietnam veteran.
So, all right, then.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. So, he's somebody I follow on Facebook, and he's always got interesting stuff to say. And I remember thinking it was either season one or season two of Better Call Saul, where I was like, if this entire show could just be Jim Beaver and what's his face? Mike Ehrmantraut, buying guns from each
Jonathan
other.
Jonathan Banks,
yeah, like that. I'm in. That's all that you have a show.
Yeah, know? that was a great scene. That whole sequence was great. Yeah.
So you're hoofing it with the books. You were on Late Night with Seth Meyers this week with Mr. Sepinwall. What prompted TV the book? How did that come about?
Well, it was just because, you know, I've known Alan since 1996. We worked together for 10 years, and we continued to talk and be friends after that. And almost any time we'd have a conversation of any length, it would invariably, at some point, steer itself into us commiserating over how bummed we were that we weren't working together anymore. So really, like, before anything else, the book was an attempt to just contrive a scenario where Alan and I could be working together for a long period of time on a particular thing. That's really what it's about. But it's also a response to both of us. You know, I've been doing this long enough, and Alan has too, that when people find out that you're a critic, and you guys know about this too, like, people who've never met you before, when they find out you're a critic, one of the first things they do is want recommendations.
Yes.
Yeah. They want, like, what should I see? It's like, and I hate answering that question because I don't know them. Like, and it's like, I don't want to, and I actually tell them sometimes, like, I say, I'd rather not answer that because I don't know you, and if I send you to a movie and you hate it, you're going to curse my name, and I really don't want that.
Yeah, see, I don't care.
You know, yeah. It doesn't matter. You don't care.
It doesn't matter. They ask me what's good.
Well, in this,
I say, you go watch, you know, A Touch of Sin. There, Cemetery of Splendor. It's my favorite film of 2016.
You heard of a little movie called Picasso Trigger?
Yeah, go do it. And if they curse my name, we were never going to be friends in the first place.
Yeah, well, so, but, you know, it's like, what should I watch that's on right now is one question, and what older shows do you like? Like, what, you know, what, if I want to get a sense of TV history, what should I be watching? So we tried to answer all of those questions at once, and it's obviously not, like, it's not a 100% comprehensive book, it's just stuff that Alan and I happen to like and recommend, that's what it is, and so... You know, you run into the same problem that you do when you create any kind of listicle, which is, you know, what about blah, blah, blah? Right. It's like, right. I don't hate that. I just didn't put it in the book.
Yeah. Well, I always, yeah. Whenever anybody comes at me with what about blah, 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 my response is always, and you won lists, because the whole reason that lists exist is to annoy you at what's included and what's not included.
Yeah. Yes.
So you, thank you for playing your role.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and also the... just the, you know, and I sometimes my response will be, well, you know, I mean, if it's a ranked list, which is, you know, I mean, the whole book, the whole Pantheon section of the TV book is a ranked list, which is ridiculous. I mean, and Alan and I are like, you know, this is ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
That we're trying to quantify art. And we're only doing it just to get people talking about what's on the list and get interested and go, why did they rank this higher than this other thing? And do I agree with that or not? And that's all that kind of stuff. But it's really just, you know, it's just a way to stimulate discussion. And I used to be very hostile to the whole idea of ranked lists, and I've gradually come to accept them as useful in certain ways. But you do get situations where it's like, well, how come, like, this blah, blah, blah is not on the list. It's invalid.
Right.
It's like, well, why don't you tell me what you would knock out to replace this with?
Oh, they'll tell you.
Yeah,
always
some of them won't, actually. That's the weird thing. It's like, well, I'm not saying that the ones on the list don't deserve to be there. I'm just saying this should have been on it.
If I am asked to rank, if I'm asked to participate in a ranking, it's either got to be something so ridiculous that the ranking doesn't matter.
Yes.
For example, the list of Madea films that I just ranked for the rap.
That's great.
Or... If the people...
By popular demand,
yeah.
I'm sure.
No, yeah, people, they liked that list, and I have an
I would like to enter the universe of Medea, but I don't know where to begin.
Yeah. And, but if it's one that, you know, people are saying, well, this should matter, this list, then I kind of intentionally go out of my way to kind of screw it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was just asked recently to do a ranking of directors...
Uh-huh.
And I thought, who cares what I think about directors? No one cares.
Yeah.
So I turned in a list of 25 female directors that I like.
Yeah.
In no order.
Right.
Well, no, I did put Claire Denis at the top because she's my favorite. But the rest of them, I just think they're all cool. And I just put them all on the list. And
you left out some of the ones I would have put in.
And I hope...
That's the whole point of lists.
And I hope somehow that would disrupt the list a little bit.
Yes.
So that was, you know.
I did
I'm going to put a book out, though, I'm going to take my time and do it properly.
years ago, I was doing a list. Every week, I had this thing called Friday Night Sights on Salon, where I do ranked lists of television and movie-related stuff. And I tried to make it as fun and interesting and surprising as I could. But also, there were times where I was just in a mood, and I would decide to deliberately antagonize the dudes.
Yeah.
The dudes.
It's so
and especially,
easy.
It's so easy.
Oh,
it's so easy and so predictable. But... I did a list of the best adaptations of comics, and I didn't say superheroes.
So it was all like
comics.
History of Violence and Ghost World.
Well, I did have Ghost World was on there, but I had some superhero titles on there, but my number one was Popeye.
Ooh.
It was Robert Altman's Popeye, and the dudes were furious. Furious. And it's like, but that's a comic? That was a comic strip before it was anything else, and I think it is the greatest comic adaptation of all time. You know?
Thimble Theater.
Indeed.
I would have gone American Splendor, but yeah, same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, okay, here's the big TV question that's weighing on all of us right now. How do you feel about the Gilmore Girls revival?
I think it's great. You know, it's like, I think bringing anything back from the dead is a risky proposition, and I think I think it's a little different. I think it's a little different because
they didn't get their last season?
Yeah, but also because this is not a show that is up in your face, huffing and puffing about how important it is.
Oh, true.
You know, it's not. It never was. Nobody thought of it. It's actually a much more influential show than I think people thought it would be at the time that it was on.
Mm.
But it's not like a Twin Peaks or the X Files or something like that, where it's freighted.
The onus of.
Yeah, where it's like, it's not like, you know, they're not coming down from the mountaintop with the Ten Commandments in their hands and handing them to us here. It's another season of Gilmore Girls, and it's a mini season. It's like. It's
four
basically
movies.
Four movies, and each one's spring, winter, summer, and fall, which is a great idea.
Mm.
You know, it's really a perfectly shaped idea. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I would be shocked if it wasn't good. I haven't watched it yet. So
are you worried about Twin Peaks?
I'll tell you what I'm worried about with Twin Peaks. I'm not worried about Twin Peaks. I think Twin Peaks, the new Twin Peaks, is guaranteed to be really, really interesting. But what I'm looking forward to is the reactions of people who haven't watched anything by David Lynch since Twin Peaks. And this David Lynch is not the David Lynch who did Twin Peaks. This is the David Lynch who has made Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive,
Empire.
And Inland Empire, and is out there like, you know, proselytizing on behalf of the benefits of transcendental meditation.
Yeah.
This is not your father's David Lynch. I mean, this dude is like, he is more radical and weird and doesn't give a shit what you want from him than ever.
Yeah.
Than ever. Like, he's the get off my lawn David Lynch now. Like, if the get off your lawn guy, get off my lawn guy was like into abstract art and dissonant classical music and like other kinds of shit that people don't enjoy.
Does he still have a line of coffees?
I think he does.
I'm sure he does. He probably does.
I think I've seen it recently. I might be wrong, but I think he still does.
Okay.
But yeah, I love that, and I love that. You know, I'm sure that it's going to be like. And also, people I think have this false memory of Twin Peaks. People have this false memory of Twin Peaks. It's like, I remember that show. It was so much fun. It was so funny and sexy and cool. And it's like, parts of it were.
Yeah.
But other parts were like, I was watching it at the time. And like, that was a show that made people really angry with its choices.
Yeah.
It's like, why did the old bellhop have to have a conversation with Agent Cooper after he was shot? I mean, it was like, the show would do things to deliberately antagonize and tease the audience. Like,
yeah.
The Sopranos later did that kind of thing, too.
It'll be interesting to see how, like, what their choices in the new version will be to sort of push the envelope. Because when you think about stuff like what the conversation about sexual abuse is now compared to what it was then, when you think about what the conversation about trans people is now compared to what it was then.
Right, when David Duchovny was on the show.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, you know, I'm wondering if they're going to be... if they're going to circle back to that stuff in a way that's interesting, if they're just going to push forward to new uncharted territories that's going to catch us by surprise, like, you know, because there is something very kind of looking at it now. There's a definite strong 90s-ness about that show.
Oh, for sure, and also the violence. You know, the violence was quite extreme. Mm. For a network TV show in 1990.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I was really shocked by some of what they put on that show. I mean, that was like the Hannibal of its day, except
right.
People actually watched it. You know?
Right.
I mean, like, no diss to Hannibal.
No. I know
there's
exactly
a reason why
know.
It finally got canceled. It,
yeah.
It was like, you know, it's a beautiful work of art that very few people were watching. So, but, and what are they going to do? Are they going to try to up the ante? What I'm hoping for is that people look at the new Twin Peaks and go, I don't know what the hell I'm looking at here. That would be, to me, that would be the sweetest victory of all. for David Lynch. So they gave him, and also he walked away. He's like, you didn't get, you know, like I'm the budgets aren't big enough. You're not paying me enough money. I'm not going to be involved. And they backed up the Brinks truck. It would be great if what he delivered was basically Inland Empire.
But yes,
it's like 5 minutes of a guy staring at a piece of pie while, you know, Laura Dern is in the background like knitting.
Yeah, and, you know? and metal machine music plays in the background. All right, let's talk about the week's new movies. You have seen Hacksaw Ridge.
I have, yes.
Which is the new Mel Gibson, and actually we all have. So, Dave, you want to explain what it's about?
Andrew Garfield is Desmond Doss. He's a real guy. True story. Served in World War II, joined up. And as he was joining up, he was like, oh, yeah, but by the way.
Did I mention
that I am a Seventh-day Adventist and I cannot touch a gun?
Yeah.
So he applies for conscientious objector status, but also wants to serve. Now, most conscientious objectors, they don't want anything to do with being in the military. He wanted to go. He just wanted to serve as a medic.
Well, yeah. I think a lot of them would serve like stateside in hospitals or whatever.
He called himself a conscientious collaborator in the movie, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. And at first, you know, everyone is opposed to this idea. And he gets beaten and he's, you know, they try to drum him out. He won't go. They court-martial him. And he wins his court-martial and they let him train to be a medic. So he goes to Okinawa, and he's with the troops as they're all killing each other with the guns, and he's dragging people to safety for triage and medical treatment. And he was the first conscientious objector at step when it comes out of my mouth, to be given the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Yeah,
yeah, you saved 75 men in the Battle of Okinawa.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, yeah, so this is Mel Gibson's first movie since, what, Apocalypto?
It is.
Yeah, as a director.
As a director,
right.
And his obsessions still seem to be firmly in place.
Oh, totally, totally. Yeah, actually, I have to say, I had a lot of issues with this movie. It's kind of a crazy movie.
It is at odds with itself.
But in an interesting way. I find I'm still thinking about it, and I don't think I would be if it were a movie that were a little bit more able to reconcile the different parts of itself.
I mean, yeah, because he's basically made this movie to celebrate a pacifist, but in doing so create some of the most like indelible war footage I've ever seen in a film.
And it's splatterific. It's not like just, oh, the horror of war. It's like, wow, that was awesome how that guy's guts flew out when the grenade hit him. Yeah, I mean, it was really like goopy, gloppy, goopy, you know, Saving Private Ryan, Saving Private Schmeien, you know?
Yeah, no, it definitely is sort of one-upping where we are with this kind of thing. And yeah, there is a balletic kind of exhilaration to this horrible, like, ultra violence. Meanwhile, you know, like, yes, pacifism, woo, you know, yay for the conscientious objector, you know.
I think there are two things happening in the film. There's the film, which can't decide what it wants to do with this man who won't fight. That the film wants to be incredibly violent, and at the same time, you know, have you admire this man. And so there's that question of who is brave that I don't know that the film, I mean, it resolves in his favor, but I don't feel it's resolved well as a film. And then on the second thing that's going on is Mel Gibson not reconciling his life with his ideals.
Right.
And he's a terrific, and I mean that in the original sense of the word, terrific. He's a terrific mess of a human being. And as a filmmaker, you know, his conflict is just right there in front of you.
Yes.
And not even when he's directing. I haven't stopped thinking about Edge of Darkness since I saw it.
Yeah.
Because he's anguished.
Yes.
in that film, and it seems like he lives with that kind of anguish all the time.
Yeah.
And so this is a messy, weird movie, like you said.
It is. It is.
And
but it also, I think, taps into that ever-popular oppressed Christian narrative that we keep getting, you know, where, like, the government and...
how much you can identify with this guy because of his pacifism. Like, I think there's a lot of people in this country who are Christians who own guns and believe that if you kill somebody in self-defense, it's perfectly okay.
But the idea that
who distinguish between murder and killing, which is something else they discuss in the movie.
But the idea that he is not, that the army will not allow this guy to have the freedom of his religious beliefs while at the same time operating as a full-class citizen, that is the hot button thing of the last several decades, where it's like, where does my right as a Christian allow me to, you know, oppress all the people that the Bible tells me I'm allowed to? You know?
Yes.
And so I think that aspect of the narrative is going to be how they sell this thing to the Passion of the Christ audiences who never went to an R-rated movie before that and haven't been to one since.
Well, like, and it's interesting that this is the third film in a row where Mel Gibson is presented an action hero who is not a traditional action hero. You know, like, Passion of the Christ is an inaction hero.
Right.
This is a guy who refused, like, God, if you think about it, like, Jesus, if he has the power to heal the sick, he could, like, He could make your heart come out of your eyes if he was pissed at you, but he chooses not to.
And he could heal himself like Wolverine.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, and it's like, so the question becomes, like, how much punishment can Jesus take? That's what that movie is, and that's obviously a subject very dear to Mel Gibson's heart as a movie star.
Yes.
And then you get to Apocalypto, which is this guy doesn't want to, he's not a warrior in the way that other people are. He just wants to hang out with his wife and kids and live in peace in his village, and he becomes an avenging action hero because he is chosen by the gods to be one. It's not something he sought out. So you get, and that's a second character hero who's basically fulfilling a heavenly destiny, and arguably this is the third one.
Interesting.
You know, so I would say he's, you know, we're at the point now where, and this is like, go with me on this, Mel Gibson is the preeminent religious filmmaker in the United States.
I agree with
no
you.
Oh, no question.
You know, I don't know. I mean, who else is there?
Because he's you know, we always talk about the faith-based movies in the show. In fact, later on in this
program,
we've
got one coming up
show. Yeah, we'll be talking about I'm Not Ashamed. But Dave always, the line that Dave always comes back to is the evangelicals drummed out their artists.
They did.
So the people who are making those movies are the hacks, because the actual complicated, you know, not everything is black and white artists are not in the fold anymore. So yeah, I'd say if only by default, Mel Gibson is absolutely our leading religious filmmaker.
Well, and also he makes R-rated movies, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm friends with a lot of film critics here. You know, one of the most active and interesting subdivisions of American film criticism right now is the liberal Christian film buffs. And like people like Peter Chataway and Alyssa Wilkinson and Jeffrey Overstreet, who I think are just, I think they're some of the best writers around of any kind. But
Justin Chang.
Yeah, and they're particularly interesting because they deal with religious themes. And one of the things that they are adamant about is, like, they're often very hard on these movies that label themselves Christian, and they go out of their way to take movies that you don't think of obviously as religious films and say, this is also a religious film, this is a spiritual film, this is a film about spiritual struggle. And one of the notes that they keep hitting it over and over is movies like, you know, Scorsese is a religious filmmaker.
Mm, yeah.
Like, consistently, like, in film after film, like, sometimes even the movies you don't think are kind of.
Right.
And, you know, Spike Lee has made a number of religious films. You know, yeah. Bad Lieutenant is a religious film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also some of David Lynch's films might qualify from a particular perspective.
Yeah.
And Gibson, I think, is, you know, he's great. He's like, he's a street preacher. He's a fire and brimstone street preacher, and he's in there screaming in your face, and he's wearing a sandwich board and ringing a bell, probably. but I like to, you know, the inability to reconcile the pacifism and the violence, like, that's what makes this such a personal film. And what I got out of the movie was, I think it would go very well on a double bill with The Passion of the Christ. Not that anybody would want to sit through that.
Right.
Because like, I think that he looks at Corporal Doss in Hacksaw Ridge the same way that he looked at Jesus in The Passion, which is an ideal that he can never live up to.
Yeah.
He can't live up to that. And
like,
he's addicted to violence just as he has been struggling with addiction to alcohol his entire adult life.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that alcoholism is a theme in the film, and addiction and recovery is a theme in the film.
I was thinking about that.
And I see this as a guy who's saying, like, I wish I were not a violence addict, but I am. I'm sorry. And I think, like, his point of identification in the movie is not DOS, but it's that other guy, Smitty, is his name, the guy who's in the foxhole with him in Okinawa.
Yeah.
And the guy flat out tells him, almost in so many words, like, you know what, I finally understand what you're about, and, you know, I can never beat you.
Right.
You know?
Well, and you know, Gibson, I think, had a long period of torturing himself on screen.
Yes.
You know, in other people's movies, and then certainly in Braveheart, and now he does it to his, like, you know, his stand-ins.
He does.
Yeah.
He does. And I just picture him as a little kid, like, being in you know, his father's church and looking at a picture of Jesus, going, well, if he was the Son of God, why didn't he just come down off the cross and kick Roman ass?
Yeah.
You know, and like that, that idea seems to animate probably half or more of his performances as a movie star.
The cinematic hair shirt, you know.
Right.
I feel like the evangelical audience, if they are pulled in to see this movie, they will probably try to compartmentalize DOS the man,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
because the current trend in the evangelical world is, you know, to be a Christian means also to, you know, go to war. And so a man who refuses to do that we can't accept that.
Right, to kick ass for the Lord.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Richard the Lionheart kind of
I don't know that attitude. it's going to provoke any conversations about violence or pacifism among the evangelicals.
The movie will provide them enough bloodlust that they can
Yes. Well, and that is and that will happen.
Well, that's the Cecil B. DeMille model in a way.
Oh, yeah, that's what
it's
I
like,
said.
Let's all get together and talk about, you know, the Lord, and it's like, and also boobies.
Yeah.
You know?
No, yeah, in my review for The Wrap, I was like, this is totally like a Cecil B. DeMille orgy. Like, isn't this terrible? Isn't God going to come smite all these people because it's so terrible? Look at how terrible this
yes,
is.
Yes, it is, yeah. Yes. Yeah, it's like the Monty Python and Holy Grail scene. It's like, oh, just a bit more peril. No, it's far too perilous.
And actually, there are moments in the battle sequences where I started thinking about the Sam Peckinpah's Salad Days sketch.
Because
it's so over the top. It's so bloody. It's like the Black Knight scene. Like, come on!
Well, and also, there's a number of moments in that battle sequence which I would argue violate the spirit of Private Doss's beliefs, if not the letter.
Yeah.
Like when he's dragging the paraplegic soldier on a homemade sled while he's machine gunning, screaming hordes of Japanese soldiers. And like my friend Sean Burns put it, it's like he's a reindeer pulling a killer Santa on a sleigh. You know,
I'm just doing my job here. Don't.
Yeah. He's like, I'm just getting you to safety. He's like, well, while you do that, you mind if I kill some more Japs? You know.
Like, I see nothing.
Yeah, it's like the movies, you know, this is a movie that's clearly working at cross purposes with itself.
and then the whole, like, opening, I mean, there's a good half an hour of, like, just kind of the hokiest sort of Norman Rockwell.
And yet, every single scene in that is there's the potential threat of lethal, horrible violence intruding. True. Like, they go out on a date and, like, she, you know, she's walking across the street and she almost gets hit by a car and it comes out of nowhere and it's a jump scare and you're like, ah! I thought this was a dating scene. And then he goes into the barracks and there's guys playing with the knife and you're like, well, this is a Mel Gibson movie, so somebody's going to get a knife in their body in the next 5 minutes. And sure enough,
you cannot relax ever.
You can't. Yeah. And it reminded me of, like, the moments in many of Mel Gibson's performances where he's having a normal conversation with somebody, a character who's supposed to be his friend or some woman he's sweet on or whatever, and suddenly he'll start doing Three Stooges routines.
Yeah. It's like a tick.
It's like, what kind of scene? He's like, what are we doing here? What scene are we doing? It's like, it's a dating scene. It's a meet cute. And he's like, okay, well, can we have a car? I almost run her over.
Well, okay, now, I just to connect this, because since you have spent the last couple of years sort of inside the mind of Oliver Stone, I think he's also somebody who has strong feelings about the nature of violence and yet also is sort of a whiz-bang master at presenting it.
Well, he has, and it's interesting that he told me that he has not picked up a firearm since Vietnam.
Hmm.
He was like, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm done. And you know, this is a guy who wrote a screenplay for a movie that was directed by John Milius, Conan the Barbarian.
Oh, right.
John Milius is a big gun guy.
Yes.
And there's actually stories, and, you know, I mention it in my book, and it's been one of the other biographies, too, that he walked into Milius's office for the first time and saw that there was a deactivated Claymore mine on Milius's desk. And he looked at it, and Milius is like, isn't it cool? And Stone said, like, yeah, you know, I was almost killed by one of these.
Well, Stone also wrote Scarface, which I think has a gun or two in it.
It certainly does. It certainly does. Yeah, yeah. No, he is. He is. But I would say, you know, we're talking about human beings as works in progress. Like, you know, I think that Mel Gibson is not nearly as far along in his process of enlightenment as Stone was at the same point in their lives. But I will say that I do see evidence of Gibson searching for meaning and trying to come to grips with himself through his art. I mean, that's what makes him a true auteur. And that's what makes his movies, even when his movies don't work or are kind of contrived or embarrassing or contradictory or kind of just don't even work in some fundamental way, that's why I still find them interesting, because I feel like he's being very honest with us.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there are certain filmmakers where you talk about how, like George Lucas being kind of the classic example, like somebody who becomes so successful and powerful that there's nobody around him to say, no, not a good idea. Yeah, let's not do this, you know.
Right.
You know, when you look at the first three Star Wars movies versus the second three, you know. And I'm wondering if in the case of Mel Gibson where, I mean, he literally has a compound, you know, in Malibu. And it's like, it's not even just that there aren't people around him to sort of question his aesthetic choices. Is there anybody around him to tell him, you know, maybe you're acting like a lunatic right now, or maybe you should like reconsider these statements or actions or whatever in your life?
I think there might be now. Yeah. Or not then.
Yes. Yeah. And also I'm not sure how much control he has over that stuff. Like he's bipolar and he's an alcoholic. I think there's probably points where he loses it and he doesn't even know that he's losing it. I mean, I've known people like that in my life, and you know that's the way they are. I'm not making excuses for the guy. I'm saying like there's some like very real physical conditions that are contributing to this too. And so what you're getting and you know Peckinpah, who's a big hero of Mel Gibson's. There's a lot of similarities between Mel Gibson and Sam Peckinpah, including the issues with women in his private life and a streak of a kind of a reactionary racist quality to some of his images. Yeah. Like, you know, Peckinpah's relationship with the Mexican-American community is not the best.
No, true.
And also the alcoholism. The alcoholism. Yeah. Like, in Peckinpah's movies, like, you can literally rank his movies. If you did a qualitative ranking of Peckinpah's films, every single time, like, the best ones would be the ones where he wasn't drinking as much. You know, The Wild Bunch and Ride the High Country, he had that stuff under control.
Right.
And then, you know, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, less so.
Right.
And then you get to, like, Cross of Iron, and it's like, you know, he's...
The Osterman Weekend.
Yeah, he's, like, sleeping on the set. Like, there would be rituals where Peckinpah would go onto the set early in the morning, and it was called thinking time. And they would say, don't leave Sam alone, he's thinking about the shot. And actually, he just had the brim of his hat down and he was taking a nap because he was hungover.
Yeah.
That's what it was. And, you know, and so I'm sure Gibson has his own version of that. But he's interesting, and I wish he'd make more movies, and I also wish that he would maybe not work in a mythic mode all the time.
Right.
Like if he made a small film that was entirely realistic and psychologically driven, I think he's a good enough actor. Like I think he understands human beings on that level that it might be really interesting. And then also like let's not have any violence this time, except maybe the emotional kind.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting. I would totally go see that movie. Did you see Bloodfather, by the way?
No.
He's quite good in it.
He's a good actor.
He is.
The dude is a good actor.
He is, and I had forgotten. You know, like I'd forgotten what a good director he is, and I forgot what a good actor he is. But like this year, it's sort of like, oh yeah, Mel Gibson. Like you're. I would want to have dinner with you, but you know, your work is interesting and it holds up.
As long as he didn't give you a ride home afterwards.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So now you have not seen Doctor Strange yet.
I have not. My son has seen it, and it's funny because like it's like he has no conception of what my life is like. He just thinks that if he doesn't see me, I'm probably watching movies.
Right.
Yeah, and he saw it. He's like, Dad, what did you think of Doctor Strange? I'm like, I haven't seen it yet. And he's like, but you're a film critic. Like, yeah.
Yeah, but with you, that's actually a fairly valid assumption.
I was traveling, but I'm going to get to it. And I haven't seen Loving. I actually was going to go to a screening of it a couple of weeks ago, and I had to cancel because my dad was in town, and the day was not going as planned. But I want to see that because I love Jeff Nichols.
Well, we're going to talk about Loving next week after Dave gets caught up with it, and when it opens wider. I mostly liked it, but yeah. we'll get into that more next week. But Doctor Strange, here's the thing. See it in 3D.
I've heard that.
Which yeah. I don't say much, but see it in 3D.
I won't go see anything in 3D. And he urged me to go to the 3D screening that they were offering. And I did. And he was right.
That's very cool.
Yeah. I mean, my eyes got tired, but...
Yes.
That's just what happens.
I don't like to go to 3D movies because... this is sort of a geeky technical explanation, but 3D, when it was originally created, it was fixed focus.
Yeah.
Like, they did deep focus, or if they did, like, split planes of focus, they weren't racking back and forth. And basically, when you're looking at 3D, your eye is trained to perceive a world that is already three-dimensional. So it has to make some adjustments to this flat image, which is pretending to be three-dimensional.
Right.
And that's like a little bit tricky for the eye and the brain. But as long as you're not constantly shifting focus and cutting a lot, it's okay. But then what happened was when this digital 3D came up, what we were seeing was movies that were directed like basically any movie would be, except in 3D, and they're racking focus a lot, they're cutting really quickly, there's a lot of really rapid camera movement, shaky cam stuff.
Yeah.
And that's fine if your eyes are healthy, but mine aren't. I have an extremely severe correction, and my right eye in particular is much weaker than my left. And I'm telling you all this to say that I took my daughter to see Avatar when it came out. And I hadn't seen one of the new 3D movies. That was the first one I'd seen. And I came out of it, and we went for pie afterwards. And we sat down in the diner, which is, you know, a properly lit space. And she was staring at me in horror. And she said, "Dad, your right eye is really, really red." And I said, "Do you mean bloodshot?" And she goes, "No, I mean red. It looks like somebody punched you in the eye." And I went into the bathroom and looked, and it did look like someone had hit me in the eye. I mean, it was like completely just a pulpy mass of red, and it was because I'd had an injury to my eye from watching Avatar.
Okay, maybe
because they're like racking them back and forth. And I actually don't go to 3D movies unless I have no other choice.
Because Avatar, like,
don't,
that's
then don't do it.
Yeah, because Avatar is probably the best made 3D movie of the contemporary lot.
Yeah.
So if that was.
I'm sort of thinking, like, maybe I'll just try to appreciate it without the 3D.
Fair enough.
If it's that kind of movie. Like, if it's that kind of movie where there's, like, cutty, 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 and a lot of shaky stuff and all that, you know?
It's a Marvel movie.
I mean, it's a Marvel movie.
Okay, well, then the answer is yes. Yeah.
So see it flat, then.
But, yeah, I'll see it flat.
But generally speaking, I don't often make the recommendation, especially for non-animated movies, like, to make it a point to see the 3D. But this one is really quite exceptional. So Doctor Strange, for folks who don't know, he was kind of Marvel's first, like, big magic superhero.
Right.
You know, Stephen Strange, brilliant surgeon, arrogant prick, gets into a car accident, has nerve damage, can't operate anymore, travels the world trying to find a cure, and winds up in Kathmandu, where he meets the Ancient One, who is played by Tilda Swinton in this, and begins to train as a sorcerer and sort of understands the kind of multidimensional nature of the universe. And, you know, for a studio movie, like, the way they present those multidimensions is pretty trippy. And you will have these, like, battles that unfold in New York where, like, all the buildings kind of turn at a 90-degree angle, and it becomes this sort of, like, M.C. Escher thing.
Right.
And you know, like, when we were
talking about everything folds into everything else.
Yeah, when we were talking about it on What the Flick, and Christy was comparing it to Inception, but it's like, but they're also fighting on the side of those buildings and running up the buildings that are
that sounds cool.
They're not just falling at 90-degree angles. They're curving and bending these buildings and interlocking and then coming unlocked, and it's...
kaleidoscopic.
It is the most exciting visual experience that I've had at one of the Marvel films.
Mm-hmm.
And I was made happy just to look at it. It's an origin story, so... Yeah. You know, the beats of that are...
Right, and like in any Marvel film, I'm assuming the last third of it is the same old boring, let's save the world shit. things crashing into other things?
Yes,
is that what happens?
And no. I mean, there is the stakes are global, but I have to say they are very smart about how they do it in terms of what happens, how the villain is battled. And also they do a really cool thing where there is a big fight sequence that involves time moving in two directions at once.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah. Now I'm really intrigued now. Because, yeah, one of my big problems with the Marvel movies is, you know, and I get into arguments with this online with people all the time, and I really should stop, but, you know, this idea that the Marvel movie, I think the Marvel movies are more similar than different, and people who love these movies are like, no, they're all so different. It's
not.
Like, you know,
they're
I think they're different.
The studio,
like,
is the auteur, is what
the
I
The studio
say.
Is the auteur, and it's like, I think they're different in the way that a Big Mac and a Whopper and an Arby's roast beef sandwich are different.
Mm.
You know, like, yes, those things are all different, but they're kind of not really.
Right.
But once in a while, you get a movie where I feel like, yeah, it is different. Like, I liked Ant-Man a lot. I liked Ant-Man because the tone was so self-deprecating and goofy,
yeah.
And it was so. It felt like a minor key Marvel film, and I liked the action scenes were so funny and sweet and stupid, and like you know the scene with the what was it?
The toy train
chase on the toy train. It's like, this is great. Like, I want more of this kind of thing where it's just, it's goofy. Like, it was like, I want more goofy superhero movies. It's okay to be goofy.
I wanted to like Ant-Man, and I wanted to see that movie as you describe it, but I didn't think it didn't quite work for me. But I on a theoretical level, yes, absolutely, take the piss and just do kind of a nutty version of it.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, and Guardians, I think, does a pretty good job.
I think Guardians did, although Guardians had that Marvel problem where when the action started, I was getting sleepy.
Mm.
I think I like everything about that movie except the action scenes, which are just, you know, except for the eccentric sense of humor, they're kind of the same old, same old.
I will say this about the Doctor Strange big final conflict. It does not boil down to people punching each other in the face.
That's nice.
We're going to have to talk about it in a different episode.
Yeah.
About the ending.
Yes.
Because I found the ending to be really unusual, not just in how... Space Face. What is his name?
Dormammu.
Yeah.
Space Face.
It's a big face in space.
It's the dread Dormammu.
It's a big face. It's a big face that comes out of the space.
In the comics, he's a face on fire. So, you know, same difference.
The way that he is fought
is
interesting to me, and in a way that I can't discuss right now, or else we give away the end.
Right. Mm-hmm. We'll circle back on this one, for sure.
But I really liked this a lot. I thought it was just visually wonderful. It wasn't too full of itself, and it wasn't too smirky.
Yeah.
It didn't try to be Guardians. It more likely aligns with something like the first Iron Man, where you're laughing at the stuff that's meant to be funny, and then the action,
which
happens.
Is about another handsome, arrogant white dude who is humbled in the East and discovers his true destiny.
That's this
interesting.
Whole other thing that's going on with this film.
There's an interesting thing about the casting of Tilda Swinton, because of course there was the immediate outrage because this was a character in the comics who was an older Asian gentleman, and the thing is, they were in kind of a no-win situation here.
Yeah.
Because you cast the Asian older gentleman, and it becomes this sort of cliched Mr. Miyagi, you know, sage of the East wisdom guy. You cast a hot young Asian woman, and then it's a dragon lady.
Right.
You make the character white, and now you're whitewashing,
Of course, you know, the one possible solution is to cast, Chiwetel Ejiofor as Doctor Strange.
Yes. Right, but
and just like, I don't know,
but
then you've still got the old Asian guy as the mentor.
That's the thing. They still
cast an Asian actor as Doctor Strange,
right? And then it becomes
and a white ancient one,
or an Asian ancient one.
Well,
you circumvent the problem of the white man going to the East to
And instead, it becomes a story of an Asian man, in some sense, reconnecting with his cultural heritage, which is interesting.
Fair enough, but I think though that it's the ancient one casting is the one that people are complaining about, and in that situation they really were there were no good options. I don't think. Or at least there would have been no options that didn't have somebody complaining about it.
Right.
So I think at least they make the ancient one. They say that she's Celtic, so they they change the thing, and I don't know. I think maybe I'm being facile, but I think when you cast Tilda Swinton, you take out a lot of you remove gender and a lot of things to the table.
Like, she is kind of a you know. Like, all categories fall in her wake.
Until we have actual people from other planets that we can cast in movies and take out the situation, she's as close as we're going to
get. No, we lost David Bowie, but we still have her.
Yes.
Yeah. I do believe that, you know, there is a way through this. There's not a no good. The idea that there is no good answer to this is, I don't think that's true. Okay. I think there is a good answer to this. And I think the answer is, cast more people of color all the time, everywhere.
Yes.
As leads, you know, and make and if you're going to change it up, change it in that direction.
Now, obviously, I'm pro that, but I'm just saying that this particular character being put into a movie, you know, was a right. minefield.
Well, as the teacher for Benedict Cumberbatch, yeah.
But you know, I respect the argument that it is indeed whitewashing, and that's the problem.
I love Tilda Swinton, and I love her in this film.
But I just think if they had cast it with an Asian person, that role being played by an Asian then becomes its own set of luggage. You know?
It is, yeah, that's true. Yeah, so, well, so this is a case where the solution was no better than the problem. But yeah, you get Tilda Swinton. I'm just heartened to hear that it's. Legitimately trying to do something different.
What I will give the Marvel movies credit for doing, for the one hand, for not being the DC movies,
right?
Which I just find like, and you know, and it's not like, oh, I want the movies to be wacky and they can't be dark. No, they could certainly be dark, but be dark in a way that is smarter than Zack Snyder is, you know?
Right.
But I think that they're realizing that they have to. Maybe not reinvent the wheel, but they can't put exact duplicates out all the time. So like they'll try and switch up something like Ant-Man, where the tone is different, or Guardians, or this. You know, I'm sure Black Panther, you know, they're making it a point to like do some cool stuff with that, and certainly like if they do something equivalent to what the Luke Cage show did.
Yes.
In terms of like really creating a sense of place and these interesting characters that have a very kind of that have a cool specificity to them, you know, I think they
like that, and I like the fact that I like the fact that Luke Cage was basically a Western.
Yeah,
you know, basically a Western. It was like a spaghetti Western set in Harlem.
True,
and he uses his fists instead of guns. You know, I mean, I think that was great.
Yeah, no, I loved Luke Cage, and I love that you could have a TV show where like let's stop for 5 minutes and talk about Chester Himes.
I thought that
was
great. I love that. You know, it's like let's have more of that kind of thing. My favorite scene in what was it? Civil War.
Uh huh.
Is where Spirit, what's his name, Scarlet Witch, and. The Vision are home alone, and he's cooking for her, and they're listening to jazz. You know, it's like I want more of that and less of like helicarrier crashing into skyscraper. It's like I've seen that before, but I've never seen like somebody cooking. What is it? Risotto? I can't remember what they're making, but it's funny. It's funny to see that.
You know, that's what always drives me nuts when people complain about the Netflix shows not having enough fight scenes. It's like, it's a 13-hour superhero movie. Can we maybe not get to the fight scene right away? Let's try some other things in there. You know?
Yeah, I like the idea of just a scene where, like, superhero My Dinner with Andre. I'm not even kidding about that.
Totally.
I'd like to see let's see Iron Man and Thor having lunch. Seriously, just talking about they can talk about superhero stuff.
The shawarma, but it's like the shawarma scene just as a feature.
As a feature. Yeah. I'm not even kidding. I would love that.
I'm totally with
you. There's 5 or 6 of the Avengers are having dinner and they're talking about stuff that is related to their job. And it's like, you know what though? You seriously need to. You need to be filing things properly. You can't just leave them on the desk and hope you get to them later because it affects us. It affects us, Thor.
I'm not going to name names, Dr. Banner. There's a comic issue I remember very vividly. There was a point where Teen Titans had been super popular throughout the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
And then at some point it came back in like the 90s, I think, or maybe early ooze, and it was just called The Titans. And literally almost the entire first issue is like out of costume, Robin, Wonder Girl, Speedy, and Aqualad having lunch in a diner and talking about putting the team back together.
That's great.
And I was like, yes, I live for this kind of crap. You know, that's totally, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think the first Avengers movie is still the best Marvel movie, because you need somebody who understands banter, and like Joss Whedon is really good at that. And you know, my favorite stuff in those, and we're going to do a whole commentary track for this movie. One of the things that I loved about the comic book was I was as interested in like what Beast and Wonder Man did on their day off than how like they all got together to battle Ultron or whatever.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I like the bit where what's his name, the Archer,
Hawkeye
is at home with his family.
Oh yeah.
I like all that business. Yeah. It's like you see him puttering around his house.
Right.
That was cool. I like that. Like I suddenly was really interested in that character, and before I only had been mildly interested. You know?
No, I'm totally with you on that. And then now neither of you saw Trolls. Do you have to go?
Like, I should go soon. You know, okay. Is it 3 yet?
It's 2:10.
Okay, that's fine. I think if I leave at 2:20 or 2:30, I'm fine.
Okay.
All right.
Well, then keep going. I'm going to just throw out Trolls real quick because neither of you guys saw it. And even though I'm in the minority, since I'm the only one in this room who saw it, I can tell you it's terrible.
But it's getting...
I was going to say, I've heard nothing but good things.
It's getting okay reviews, though, right?
Hated it.
Really? What did you hate about it?
Okay, well, for one thing, did you see Strange Magic?
Yeah.
They do that thing where they, like, dig up a lot of old pop songs and do these, like,
the Shrek thing,
twinkly little cover versions, yeah, right. The Shrek thing, basically, which is just annoys the crap out of me. So like, you have to hear them butcher like September and The Sounds of Silence and True Colors and Junior Seniors Move Your Feet, and it's just ugh. And there's like a couple. There are a couple of originals.
I love it when you make that noise.
That's a poster blurb if I ever saw one.
There are a couple of original songs that are okay. One of them is apparently this Justin Timberlake mega hit of the year. That I was, of course, unaware of.
It blows my mind that you have not heard that
song. Yeah, Christy gave me the business on that one, too.
I don't understand you.
Anyway, so those songs are okay, and if they'd made this like an original musical, I think I would have been more tolerant, but all the covers are so annoying. And then it's just, the color scheme is eye assaultive. I mean, it is so like sparkly rainbow, you know, and then like the mean ogres are all like, you know, poop brown, basically, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the capper of all this is that the movie is the premise is that the ogres that are called the Bergens discover that the only way they can feel true happiness is if they eat a troll. And the movie begins with the trolls, you know, it's like the annual day where they're going to be eaten, and they manage to escape. And they live off in the forest, and they're fine for 20 years. When they give a big party celebrating their anniversary, they get spotted, they get dragged back into Bergen town. And then they have to sort of teach the Bergens how to become happy without eating them, you know. And so the message of the movie is happiness isn't about things. It's about, like, it's a feeling and it's about an experience and da-da-da. And it's like, I'm sorry, this is a movie that is entirely existing to sell toys.
Right.
It is based on pre-existing toys. You've made new ones that you're now going to market the hell out of.
Right.
And you have the gall to make a movie that is anti-materialist?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can. That's a trap that a lot of these things fall into, and it's a very old trap. Like, I remember one of my very favorite things that's ever aired on television is the Charlie Brown Christmas special, in part because it has a sincerely Christian anti-materialist message.
Right.
But then in reruns, it would, you know, they would cut from that to the Peanuts advertising MetLife or Dolly Madison.
Right. Well,
so true, it's like, my sister, my daughter.
And I had this argument on What the Flick, and Chrissy's like, well, you know, they made Inside Out dolls. I'm like, yeah, but the message of Inside Out wasn't like, you don't need to own crap to be happy. And this...
Also, the plot line that you just described sounds an awful lot like a parable of, like, racism or genocide or something.
There is a genocidal undercurrent to it, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I was just...
not something you necessarily want to, you know, polish and hold up for the young kids. But you know, I'm often accused of overthinking movies, which is really funny to me because I don't feel
it's not supposed to be an Oscar-winning drama, Matt.
Yeah, but it's like even the animated movies. I'm very hypercritical of the architecture of movies like that. What's the underlying story here?
What are we saying?
And what was that movie of Zootopia?
Mm-hmm.
It bothered me.
That waded into some complicated racial waters.
It did, and it's like the predators and the prey.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I don't know about this. And like, also this idea, like, the problem with that is the predators who eat meat, they have to eat meat. It's not a choice.
Right.
It's not a choice. So they're, like, they're conflating oppression with biological necessity.
Yeah, that movie...
And it's like, okay, I don't know what end is up now.
That movie got into some metaphorical minefields, you know.
Parents, take your children to see The Greasy Strangler. Sidestep all of this... Turn your kid weird early.
The other problem with trolls is, like, you know, Justin Timberlake plays, like, the emo troll who's, like, not happy. And he, at one point, we build up to the big scene where he explains why he doesn't sing and dance like all the other ones. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be, like, this serious moment. And that's the biggest laugh I had in the film. It was not unlike the Phoebe Cates Santa Claus speech in Gremlins, only that was at least intentionally weird and funny. This was just like, what?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I had that thought at the end of Zootopia where the fox character, who's a thief,
mm-hmm.
like, when you finally get to his backstory, and who was the actor who did that? It was the guy,
Jason Bateman.
Jason Bateman. It's like, you've got a fox voiced by Jason Bateman telling you a story that is basically like, this. Here's, let me tell you about the day that I decided to embrace my own racial stereotype. That was what that story was. Basically, right, right. It's like, Oh, you think the foxes are evil? I guess I'll be the evilest fox of all.
Right.
That was what that was about. It's like, okay, so we have a story of, like, self, like, internalized racism, essentially. It's like, I don't think the movie's up to this. You know, I mean, like, I respect that you even thought about going there, but you shouldn't be going there because you can't deal with this.
It's kind of like The Incredibles is a movie that I love, but also if you start thinking really hard about what the message of it is, it's like, oh, so this is my first Atlas Shrugged then. You know?
It is.
So, yeah, it's kids' movies need to, like, be mindful of, because, you know, it's very easy. And it's not even like you have to dig that deep to go into these tangents. Like, they're kind of sitting there.
Well, and also they're like, I think it's like a risk of anytime you deal in metaphor, simile, comparisons of any kind, if you look at it a little too closely, it starts to fall apart. And, like, I even run into that on Twitter, and it's like, you know, it's like, well, if such and such a movie is a stale sandwich, then this is a, you know, rancid casserole or something like that. Yeah. It's like, yeah, but the casserole, and, like, people start picking it apart. I mean, it's like, wouldn't you say that it's more like a burrito? I should just never make comparisons.
That's like that.
I should just never make
that. That Doonesbury where Honey is testifying against Madame Mao in the Gang of Four trial. They're like, you said that she was a cringing cur, but earlier you said she was a sniveling cockroach. Well, which is it? This is a glaring contradiction in your testimony.
So... I saw I'm Not Ashamed.
All right, this is gonna be a while. We should probably let Matt go.
It's not gonna be a while.
Okay.
I'm gonna knock it out.
All right, all right, all right.
2.5 weeks ago this film was released, and it's already gone from theaters. But it needs to be talked about.
Yes, attention must be paid. Because, it is from Pure Flix.
Because it's from Pure Flix, and because of my ongoing need to see every evangelical film that comes out. No matter how small and bad.
There's a Christmas one this year.
Which one is
what's
that?
Believe, about the jerk rich guy who becomes friends with a sassy black tween and saves the town's Christmas festival.
All right, I'll buck up for that.
This sounds great.
This is the Columbine movie.
Yes, it is.
And it was...
And like God's Not Dead, it's based on an anecdote that may or may not be true.
Yeah. Mm. Well, but here was what... It's actually based on a real girl.
Yes.
Rachel Scott was one of the 12 people, one of the 12 teenagers killed at Columbine. She happened to keep extensive journals. And those journals were, after her death, those journals were made very public. And an organization called Rachel's Challenge sprung up, and they do presentations at schools all over the country. Although they are evangelical based, apparently the presentations are not overtly religious. They're about bullying and stuff like that. Now, the movie, unfortunately, in the title, you get the trouble coming. The idea of being ashamed of being a Christian is something that is hammered into the Sunday school lessons and Bible studies of every teenage evangelical Christian. The idea that you are meant as a teenager, generally, you know, a suburban teenager in a evangelical church, probably a mega church at this point in history, because that's what they're all becoming. Your job as a teenager is to go out into the school and be a witness for Christ. Now, anybody who's listening to this show for the first time who doesn't know what I'm talking about, I grew up this way, so I know exactly what I'm talking about. I know this language that these folks use. I know this world inside and out. And so the idea of being ashamed is something that is presented as like the worst possible thing that you can be as a teenage Christian.
Right.
And yet, it is presented to you in your life as a Christian, as being the greatest punishment for being a Christian. Okay, so it's not like the Romans are feeding you to the lions. The worst punishment that you get for being a teenage Christian in the United States is they're all going to laugh at you, and they might or they might not, depending on where you live. If you live in the South,
yeah, you're in the majority.
Like I did, yeah. you're no one's going to come at you,
no,
ever. They're going to laugh at you maybe for not.
There's more giant crosses on the landscape in the former Confederate states than probably anywhere outside of Brazil.
Yes. yeah, they're not.
There's no persecution of Christians happening in that part of the country.
They're gonna mock you maybe anywhere. for not partying, but that's about it.
Right. Yeah.
So. That's kind of what happens in this movie. All her friends party all the time. Like, I've never seen more smoking or drinking in a Christian film than this one. Because she navigates this world of secular teenagers sort of hiding her faith. And then going home and writing about how she feels ashamed about the fact that she's hiding her faith and ashamed of the fact that she's ashamed of being a Christian. She falls for a guy in the drama club who calls himself spiritual, which that's code, by the way. Mm. Spiritual is code for you don't believe in Jack.
Yeah.
No,
you probably go to yoga.
Yeah, yeah. You probably go to yoga.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, here's the Columbine story bubbling up. The characters Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris.
Oh, God. Really? I have a horrible premonition of where this is going.
Shown playing video games.
If
there's one really funny scene in this film, it's the one where they're playing a video game. It's a first-person shooter game, of course.
Match.
And one of them says to the other, "This should be Columbine." And the other one says, "It could be."
Oh, my God. Really?
Now, I don't know if they actually said these things to each other. But the film doesn't know either, and it pretends...
Is there a little ding?
Yeah.
When he says that?
It pretends it knows.
It's because so crazy, it presents
as factual this thing, and it presents as factual the utterly apocryphal story that has become the most famous story to come out of that situation. When they came up to the girl and said, "Do you still believe in Jesus?" And she said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, go meet him." Bam, right in the head. That was her.
Okay.
That was allegedly Rachel
Scott. If that happened.
Now, they did shoot her in the head. Yes. But we don't know if she said that thing. Well, in the movie, she says that thing.
Mm. Right.
The other thing, and this is the most egregious crime of the film, which, by the way, in terms of evangelical cinema... And in terms of Pure Flix, which is the, you know, the Warner Brothers of Christian entertainment.
They're the God's Not Dead studio.
Right.
Kind of the most competently made film that they've ever put out.
Really? I
mean, it's not inept. It's not good.
Well, I thought you said its cheapness was showing.
Well, its cheapness is showing. But that's, I mean, all of their movies show the cheapness. Mm. The Hallmark Christmas movies are better made than this sort of thing.
Right.
They attribute the motivations of the two shooter kids to Charles Darwin and the teaching of evolution.
Oh.
And they conflate this with the idea of social Darwinism, which has absolutely nothing to do with natural selection.
Right.
And they make great hay of the fact that one of the guys did, in fact, wear a T-shirt on the day that said natural selection on it. Because they were into Hitler, and they were into the idea of, like, you know, weeding out the weak and everything. They apparently, they weren't bullied at all. They were just creeps.
Right.
And so, but the film blames it on evolution. And it's really...
That's quite a reach.
Really crazy. Yeah. So it's a, it's one more Christian disaster in a theater, at a theater not near you anymore. It's gone. But it'll be streaming in DVD soon enough.
Oh,
if you're curious.
I bet it might still be showing in certain markets.
I don't know. Mm. It didn't do well.
Not okay. With Doctor Strange playing.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
PureFlix has an agenda now, and their agenda is make that money.
Yeah.
Make that God's Not Dead money. Make $60 million on your $500,000 film. And if it doesn't do that, it's out. The Hillsong movie was going to be their big thing.
Oh, yeah. Nobody went to
Went to that. And so, you know, they better watch out or they're going to bankrupt themselves.
They're going to be the new Vestron.
Yeah.
All right. Matt has got things to do, places to go. Tell us again, where can people find you online and what are you, what should they be buying off of you this holiday season?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Matt Zoller Sites, MattZollerSeitz. And it would be great if you would consider buying a copy of The Oliver Stone Experience, which is my book about the life and work of Oliver Stone, or TV the Book, which is a guide to the greatest American television shows that I wrote with Alan Sepinwall, my longtime friend.
And I will I'll post links to both on our Facebook page.
And do not at him on Twitter with your stupid little comments.
I'm sure he gets it a lot.
Oh, I know he gets it a lot. I see him fighting with people all the time.
Everybody just step back. Be nice. All right, Matt, always a pleasure to see you, sir.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, so, you know, go check out all the things that I always tell you to check out at the end of this program. You know, our friends on the internet and all that stuff. Follow us at Linoleum.
Are we done?
Yeah, aren't we?
Okay.
Yeah. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Subscribe for free at iTunes. If you want to leave us a review there, that'd be great. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. You can leave us a nice feedback and response at all the places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Podbean, Satchel, and CastBox. And you can drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. That's where you can also purchase... You know what? We need to talk about holiday stuff. So I'm going to pause for a second. We're going to let Matt get out of here.
No. We don't need to. We'll do it next time.
Okay, fine.
It's
anyway,
not the end of the world.
If you want to buy a t-shirt, it's
you're already on a roll.
The t-shirts are $22. The deluxe edition of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas is $20. PayPal is at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Ask about sizes first.
Ask about sizes and let
us running out of sizes.
And tell us about addresses. Yeah. And of course, join our club, patreon.com/linoleumknife. We appreciate your support, and we will catch you guys next time.
Goodbye.